Let's join together in the spirit of prayer. Spirit of life-giving love and love-giving life, we've gathered together here once again this morning in sacred community so that we might know that we are indeed a part of something larger than ourselves, so that we might have faith in that larger sense of goodness, so that we might have hope that there are possibilities beyond our own individual making, that we might have charity and love, having recognized the many gifts that we've been given and the many gifts that have not been so evenly distributed across even our town, but our community, our state, and our country, and our world. We come together in faith and in hope and in love. Let us each find that level of comfort that tells us we are indeed who we ought to be, that this life is indeed the gift that has been given to us, and that we are the ones who are able to find and make meaning in that life. Let us hold this moment together in quiet. Amen.
Our first reading this morning is from the ancient text of Nehemiah. While I was in the citadel of Susa, one of my brothers came from Judah with some other men, and I questioned them about the Jewish remnant that had survived the exile, and also about Jerusalem. They said to me, "Those who survived the exile and are back in the province are in great burned with fire." When I heard these things, I sat down and wept. For some days I mourned and fasted and prayed. Trouble and disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down, and its gates have been set afire. Our second reading is from a passage of the book On Being Human Religiously by James Luther Adams. Few things in human history are fixed, least of all reputations. As Santana remarked of Hamlet, the reputations both of the great figures of fiction and of their creators have usually had an evolution and a history. One age extols Shakespeare as abiding our every question. Another age devotes to improving him. One age wishes Milton could be living at this hour. Another regards him as the blight of English poetry. One school honors Plato as the father of all orthodoxy. Another excommunicates him as the source of all heresy. Hence the admonition, "Let us now praise famous men," raises again and again the questions, which men and how praise them?
So 18th century Unitarian minister, philosopher, and transcendentalist Ralph Waldo Emerson once commended a class of Harvard Divinity School graduates, saying to them to preach by raising up the issues of their day so that those issues might be better viewed through the lenses of religious sensibilities and values. To what end? So that we might be better prepared to relate to those issues in intentional and in transformational and in religious ways. I don't think that the suggestion from Emerson is that the preacher ought to direct what the responses from the pew should be. The suggestion is only that it is essential within the spiritual religious quest to ground our religiosity in the real world and to lift up that real world, the one in which we currently live, with the deference and the esteem that we might more typically reserve for matters of the divine, denying the possibility that those two concerns are separate from one another. It is within the realm of the preacher's responsibility, Emerson suggests, to invite the gathered congregation to consider who they are in relationship to these events of the day, so that those members might choose their own course of relationship in response to them. I take both parts of Emerson's charge to heart. I try regularly to hold before you the worldly happenings of our time in an attempt to invite you to view our relationships with those events in ways that might make our lives more religious, more spiritual, by being more connected to our world. And I do not presume or want to even appear to presume that your responses ought to be any particular responses. Those are yours. The question raised is my job. The response is yours. So today marks the 57th day of Occupy Wall Street, which began on September 27th over at Zuccotti Park in Manhattan. Since it started, the movement has spread to over 100 cities across the country and over 1,500 cities around the world. Occupy Wall Street has become something more of an Occupy Main Street movement. It has developed everywhere. It has become a major event of our day, one well worth, I think, our investment of attention and inquiry through the use of our religious lenses and sensibilities. And so I begin with this thought by Quaker theologian and author who I love greatly, Wendell Berry. Berry wrote, "It may be when we no longer know what to do, we have come to our real work. And that when we no longer know which way to go, that we have begun our real journey." I wonder how many of you have had the chance to get over to Zuccotti Park since the occupation has begun. A few of you. I've had the opportunity twice now. My first visit was on a very warm, sunny, early autumn afternoon, and my second visit was on a colder, windier, mid-autumn morning. The primary difference in those two experiences was that on my first encounter, the community was just out there. Talk about transparency. The predominantly young crowd was living out in the open in view of the whole world. Their lives and their possessions, including sleeping bags and everything else, were just there on display for everyone to witness. There was an immediate feeling of connection with those demonstrators. There were no sanitary facilities available except for, of all ironies, at a sympathetic McDonald's about a block away. And the word on Liberty Square, though, about that restroom was that it should be used discreetly and only when it was absolutely necessary. Can you imagine? And that was only during the course of business hours when McDonald's was open, not nighttime when old people... Anyway. Still, there was no olfactory or visual evidence of the absence of sanitary facilities in the encampment. And one other thing that was there, though, lots and lots of drumming. My second visit, a few weeks later, was a few days after our big pre-Halloween snowstorm. By then, the park was carpeted with waist-high camping tents, occasionally interspersed by larger tents that were used for the information center, for first aid, for women's dormitories, and for food collection and distribution. Many of the encampment residents were inside of their tents when I visited that time, and much of the intensity that I had witnessed on my first visit was less visibly tangible, but it was still quite palpable in the square. You couldn't see it so well, but you could feel it. Many of the Liberty Square residents who were out and about that morning were quite engaged in the organization of the enterprise as well as engaging with passersby. There wasn't any drumming going on this time, save a solitary bongo drummer who sat atop one of the surrounding marble walls, and he was playing very quietly, mostly just to himself. But another huge difference was that some porta-potties had, in the interim, been put into place just a couple of blocks away, and they were available after a short trek around the clock. And I don't know maybe that had something to do with the dissipating need for the drumming. Maybe it didn't. On both visits, what was clear to the observer was how, for the most part, this was and is a young person's movement. And still it felt important for people like me, older and perhaps more conventional in appearance, to be there in order to support both those who were there for the long haul living out on the street, and also in order to bolster the visible numbers and the visible diversity of the movement so that it might continue to be an event that could draw national and international attention. The press was everywhere on both of those visits. So what was also clear was the very earnest desperation on the part of the participants. This was on both of the visits. There was and is an urgency, a dire urgency in their desperation. There are so many different groups who are represented there: the unemployed, the underemployed, the educated, unemployed with enormous college loan debts, the homeless and the newly homeless who lost their homes because of foreclosure, union members who are being squeezed, and people who were every color of the rainbow, and people who had hair that was literally every color of the rainbow. They and others were all there, desperate for a change in the business-as-usual intercourse of a whole host of human affairs, from social to political to religious to economic. They had identified corporations as the standard bearers of the status quo. And so it was within the shadows of those symbolic corporate temples of downtown Manhattan that they brought their protest. I want to read from the concerns posted by the Occupy Wall Street Press, and I'll print the entirety of that declaration in the text form of this sermon, but I just want to share a little bit of the flavor of it with you here. It begins, "As we gather together in solidarity to express feelings of mass injustice, we must not lose sight of what brought us together. We write so that all people who feel wronged by the corporate forces of the world can know that we are your allies. As one people, united, we acknowledge the reality that the future of the human race requires the cooperation of its members, that our system must protect our rights, and upon corruption of that system, it is up to the individuals to protect their own rights and those of their neighbors, that a democratic government derives its just power from the people, but corporations do not seek consent to extract wealth from the people and the earth, and that no true democracy is attainable when the process is determined by economic powers. We come to you at a time when corporations which place profit over people, self-interest over justice, and oppression over equality run our governments. We have peaceably assembled here, as is our right, to let these facts be known." And then they go on to list some 23 grievances against the current system of things, and they range from homes being lost through foreclosure to college loans to influence on the courts, influence in elections, many, many things that you should read. You could get it on websites. You could get it in the text of this. And then the document concludes, "To the people of the world, we, the New York City General Assembly, occupying Wall Street and Liberty Square, urge you to assert your power. Exercise your right to peaceably assemble, occupy public space, create a process to address the problems we face, and generate solutions accessible to everyone. To all communities that take action and form groups in the spirit of direct democracy, we offer support, documentation, and all of the resources at our disposal. Join us and make your voices heard," it concludes. So I have to admit that as something of a socialist, I have considerable appreciation for many of those 23 concerns that are being levied by the protester. Things are incredibly broken in our world and in our institutions, and we, humanity, have broken them. In so many ways, this is the result of the hegemony of the corporate-driven world economy. And the current state of things is that nations make laws and argue with one another while corporations make fortunes and profits and then roll over one another or anyone or anything else that might stand in the way of those profits. At the same time, I have to admit that as something of a capitalist, I have considerable trepidation regarding the viability of anarchy. First, there are many corporations whose mission it is to make profits for shareholders in responsible and sustainable ways. And second, In order to serve the needs of humanity, we need institutional systems that recognize and respond to the dynamics of supply and demand. Meeting the needs of humanity is a religious quest, especially for those of us with universalist leanings. Corporations are among the institutional manifestations of just those religious leanings. The problem is that things have gotten so far out of whack that no one, not the Wall Street occupiers, not the top-heavy institutions of corporate structures, no one knows how to get those things back into whack. The governments of this new global world do not hold the answers either. They have yet to learn how to promote the general welfare of their own citizens within the context of their newly reduced sovereign roles. The walls of Jerusalem are indeed breaking down, and those who have so far survived are growing fewer and fewer in number, the middle class is dwindling to naught, and the numbers of those falling beneath the poverty line is growing exponentially. Wendell Berry wrote, "It may be when we no longer know what to do, we have come to our real work, and that when we no longer know which way to go, that we have begun our real journey." It occurred to me on my first visit, and it was re-emphasized the second time I visited the site, that it was very clear that the grievances were listed, but I wasn't hearing any direction about what it was that we need to do. And that did not occur to me in its fullness until I was able to sit to write this very sermon. It seems that our real work is at hand, and that we have now to embark on a journey that will allow us to reclaim prosperity to the land and to its people. The thing is, though, that we're going to have to learn new ways of doing things that will be sustainable. The old ways will not get us there. And because we have lost grasp to some very considerable extent, lost grasp of some of our basic and universal ecological and human needs, we will need to recognize and employ new ways that can get us all to where we want to be going. So I thank goodness for the young people in the Occupy Wall Street movement as they bring home not necessarily solutions to the problems we face, but at least an articulation of so many practices that are simply untenable in a world where we affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person, in a world where we affirm and promote the interdependent web of existence of which we are a part. The OWSers are helping to show the rest of us that we really don't know what to do. And that's humbling. And yet they are showing us where we must begin our journey. And that can be empowering, even if it is frighteningly empowering. We might look at what the folks in Zuccotti Park and encampments across the country and around the world are doing as the articulation of prayer. Their actions on their own behalf and on ours are a sort of a prayer in the face of not knowing what to do, a humble supplication of sharing in the responsibility for what has gone wrong and a willingness to participate in making things right, an open-ended request for whatever wisdom might be found to lead the world forward and out of this chaotic injustice. Now let us praise good persons. Industry and the corporation were instrumental in building and making this country great. Still, a new day has dawned, and a new kind of greatness is required. It is one that will need the kind of spiritual religious values, the spiritual religious fortitude that cannot allow for any chosen few to reign supreme. It is one that will demand a vision of justice with a wisdom that recognizes the interconnectedness of all beings and all things. It is in these very connections, I believe, the connections, the interweave, I believe the connections of industry and labor, of values and fortitude, of wisdom and justice, where we will find evidence of the divine that speaks to us in this, our time. And I have faith that it is through our participation at those junctures of connection where we will find the very fertile ground that we need now and that we will always need to grow our souls and to feed our spirits. And so, if you've come here for answers today about what ought to be done regarding those Occupy Wall Street movement people or what we should do about the concerns that they raise. If you've come for answers to questions about that, I'm sorry. I have only my questions to add to yours. But I do know this. We don't get to choose the world that we're born into. And yet, we do get to choose, in fact, must choose, how we will live in it. And the occupiers are right. The power is ours. So let us then raise up the issues of our day so that those issues might be better viewed through the lenses of our religious sensibilities and values. It is time, in the very larger scheme of things, for prayer. And may our prayers not always be so silent. Take courage, friends. The way is often hard and the path is never clear, and the stakes are so very high. Take courage, for deep down inside there is yet another truth. You are not alone. May the prayers of our hearts and the songs of our lips shared in this holy hour of worship be with us now and in our days to come. As this worship comes to an end, we extinguish our chalice and our service begins. Blessed be, and amen.